This is Betty Trammell with Oral History, sponsored by the Decatur Public Library. Our guest today is Mr. R. Graham, General Manager of radio stations WSOY and Y103 FM. Welcome to our series, Mr. Graham.
Thank you.
It's hard to imagine a world without broadcasting, isn't it? But radio is comparatively recent.
Well, comparatively, so I guess it's a matter of your age. If you're 20 years old, radio's been around for a long time.
Right.
But radio came to Decatur in the mid-20s. So I guess, as history goes, radio really is recent.
Well, Decatur was really early in the field.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, Decatur has the third oldest radio station in the nation. As you know, KDKA in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, was the first station on the air, commercial station, I should say. Second station, I don't know who it was nor where it was. Third station on the air, though, in this nation was reported to be WDZ, which is a Decatur station. At that time, it was not a Decatur station. It was located in Tuscola, Illinois. And it signed on in, what, 1924, something like that. And it was owned by a grain company, and every half hour they turned on their transmitter and broadcast the Chicago Board of Trade grain prices, and that's all they did. A minute or two on the air, and then they'd turn off their transmitter, and a half hour later turn it back on and broadcast the grain prices again. And they are known and recognized as the third oldest station in the nation. And the oldest station in Illinois, and they are now in Decatur, WDZ. It's an AM station. In Decatur proper, though, this radio station went on the air under different ownership and different identification and different dial position in September of 1925. Went on the air as WJBL Radio. It was owned by the William Gushard Company. Went on the air with a power of 500 watts. It was located in studios atop what is now a building owned by Kay's Merchandise Mart at the northwest corner of William and Water Streets. The building more recently was known as the Carson Perry Scott Building when they were downtown. So perhaps you can see the building in your mind. And I'm told that back in 1925, they had two windmill-type operations sitting on top of the building, and a wire strung between the two served as the antenna.
Oh.
And that was their transmitting antenna. That's the way it worked. And we still have in our collection of memorabilia here at Radio Park, we still have some of the old microphones and pictures from the original WJBL studios. That was in 1925. William Gushard was the owner. In 1937, Decatur Newspapers Incorporated bought WJBL Radio. And Decatur Newspapers Incorporated included the Decatur Herald and Review and the members of the Lindsay Shaw family and the Lindsay Shaw organization. They bought 49%, I think, of what was then known as Commodore Broadcasting Company. They later acquired 100% of it and eventually changed the call letters to WSOY. As I remember reading some of the history about the change in call letters, they were trying to decide what call letters might be available that would suit them best. And they investigated call letters like WDEC, which would have been obviously for Decatur. And for some reason that I don't know, that was turned down. They even considered WVLD, Voice of Lake Decatur, at one time. As you know, call letters many times represent things like, like ownership and organizations like WCFL in Chicago is the Chicago Federation of Labor, LS in Chicago stood for the world's largest store. It was owned by Sears Roebuck and Company. WBBM stood for, that's a Chicago station, that stood for the kind of music they broadcast. It was, we broadcast better music, WBBM. So the voice of Lake Decatur, WVLD, might have been very appropriate, but that was turned down. And at the same time, at about the same time that this move to change the call letters was taking place, Decatur was becoming known as the soybean capital of the world, and the decision was made to change it to WSOY. And that was back in the, I believe, in the late 30s. Mm-hmm. Interesting thing at about that time that you might find interesting. There is a radio station in Bloomington, WJBC. Back in those days, this radio station, WJBL, was at 1,200 on the dial, 1,200 kilocycles. WJBC in Bloomington was also at 1,200 on the dial.
That's too close, isn't it?
Well, it's impossible. The arrangement, and this was all made, I presume, by the owners of the two stations working with the Federal Communications Commission. The arrangement was WJBL would broadcast from Decatur for a while, and then they would sign off, and WJBC in Bloomington would sign on and take that dial position for a while. And they would switch back and forth for a while. If you were listening at 1200 on the dial, for a while you would listen to the WJBL Decatur. Apparently it did. And I've heard of many other instances, none that I can think of specifically, but a shared frequency was not unusual back in those days. Later, WJBL, which was to become WSOY, was able to change frequencies by working some arrangement with a Terre Haute, Indiana station, WBOW, I believe, swapped frequencies, and WJBL was able to move to 1340 on the dial. WJBC in Bloomington moved to another dial position. I don't know what position, but as a result of those changes approved by the FCC, both stations were allowed to, were able to go on the air full time. No more shared frequency. And that occurred back in the late 30s.
Very good. Well, you told us one or two of the people who were responsible for the early radio here, but were there any others?
Specifically, let me mention a fellow named Merrill Lindsay. Merrill Lindsay was with a part of the Lindsay Schaub family, Decatur Newspapers Incorporated, which bought the radio station. He was the station manager here and then general manager for a long, long time. He, I believe, is viewed by most people who know broadcasting indicator and who know business and communications indicator. He's probably viewed as the real father of broadcasting indicator, even though radio had been on the air for 10 or 12 years before he and his family became involved. I think Merrill Lindsay is a fellow who really made it move forward. With Merrill Lindsay's leadership, the call letters were changed to WSOY from WJBL. The frequency was changed so that the radio station could be on the air all the time. The power was increased. Back originally, this radio station was at 500 watts, then it became 1,000 watts daytime, 250 watts at night, and then eventually it became 1,000 watts 24 hours a day. Under Merrill Lindsay's leadership as well, WSOY-FM went on the air. Under his leadership, this radio park was established with these studios built in and occupied in early 1948, almost 40 years ago now. And at the time, the most modern radio broadcasting facility in the entire state, including Chicago at the time that it was built. Radio made a great deal of progress in Decatur, I think, as a result of the knowledge and the efforts and dedication of Merrill Lindsay. So that's one name that you just can't overlook when you think of communications in Decatur.
Very good. What about programs in those days when they started, or any programs that you remember especially from the past?
Well, we're talking specifically about WSOY now. Back years ago, programs were mostly national. The national networks, the Columbia Broadcasting System, yeah. The National Broadcasting System, Mutual Broadcasting System, the American Broadcasting System. You know, you never hear the names anymore. You only hear the CBS, the ABC, the MBS, Mutual Broadcasting System, and NBC. But the very early programs before the networks used a lot of local talent, local musicians, a lot of local musicians. Not very much information, mostly music and entertainment, performed locally. Then came the networks and the Arthur Godfreys and Ma Perkins and all of the radio soap operas filled the airwaves. Indicator, we became CBS back in, when? I think I have it here somewhere when WSOY became an affiliate of CBS, May of 1943, Ma Perkins was on the air in Decatur through the network. But the network would give a chain break at about 28 and a half minutes past the hour and about 58 and a half minutes past the hour, and the local stations would originate a commercial or maybe a weather forecast and a station identification. But most of the rest of the day was taken up by network programming. There would be breaks for local programming of news and information. But programming was mostly national program, as television programs are today. And then back in the, I suppose, the late 50s, it began to change when television came along and radio programming changed to a great deal of locally produced programs. And very few network programs outside of newscasts and sportscasts and special events. But I don't think you can look at the history of American radio or Decatur radio without thinking of Lum and Abner and Ma Perkins and the great radio dramas and comedies, you know, the Jack Benny Show and things of that sort. And they were all right here on this station for many, many years.
And we sometimes hear rebroadcasts of those programs today.
It's kind of fun, too, isn't it?
Nostalgia.
Yes.
We know that programs have changed a good deal from that time, as you say. What about equipment?
Oh, equipment has changed dramatically. There were days back when before I started in radio, I had a recorder at home, a home recorder. But it was not a tape recorder.
What was it?
It was a wire recorder.
Oh.
And you recorded, the wire was a magnetic recording surface just like your tape, similar to your tape. But you recorded on a spool of wire, and the wire would run from one spool to the other just like the tape does on an open reel tape machine. And that wire would come loose and become entangled, and it was a terrible mess, and the equipment was extremely heavy. A home recorder, a portable recorder, probably weighed 50 pounds, and it was awkward, and it did not have good quality. Microphones back then didn't have good quality. Today,
they were very large, weren't they?
Oh, large and heavy. They had those very heavy transformers in them, and yeah, they weighed a ton. Radio stations recorded back in the 40s on either a wire recorder or on even a disc recorder. A lot of radio stations, including this one, made recordings on a disc. A commercial was recorded on a disc, just like today's 45 RPM record. Like the discs were known as ETs, electrical transcriptions.
They were done locally.
They were done locally.
Right in the station.
Right in the station. And an announcer would sit in a studio, an engineer, operator would sit in the control room, and the operator would put the record cutter, if you will, for lack of a better word, the actual device that cut the groove in the record as it recorded the sound, the audio, onto the disc. He'd put it down and cue the announcer. The announcer would read the commercial or whatever. And if you goofed, as announcers are prone to do, I can say that because I have been one. If you goof, they start it over and start it over and start it over. So you may record on that disc several tracks with your commercial before you ever got it right.
And I understand that sometimes that thread or chip they cut away would become fouled around the...
Around the cutting head. That's absolutely right. Become foul and just mess up the whole process. So you'd start over and start... And you couldn't reuse those discs. You know, you use your tape over and over and over again. You just run it across a tape eraser and you use the tape again. The discs, you couldn't use again. You used them once. So they ran through a lot of recording discs. We still have some of those old ETs here around the building. They were big 16-inch, I believe, discs, great big huge things, and they played, as I recall, at, well, I started to say 33 and a third RPMs, but now I'm not certain about that.
They were, well, go on.
Other changes in equipment you know about today as you walk through a radio studio, you see digital equipment, you see cassette recorders, the change from recording techniques using wire recorders or disc recorders changed to reels of tape with a reel-to-reel tape machine, which is still common today and used a great deal today, and eventually to cartridge tape machine, where what amounts to a loop of tape that would be, say, 40 seconds long and not have any end to it, all enclosed in a little case they called a cartridge, and from that it gets its name. And you'd slip this little cartridge of tape into a machine and press a record button. That record button implants a tone that is not heard on the air on that tape at the point where the tape is located at the time you insert the cartridge in the machine. Then when you hit the play button, to start the machine, you record then a 30-second commercial on this 40-second piece of tape. When the tape cycles back around to where that inaudible tone is located, then the tape automatically stops. And when it stopped, it's ready to play again automatically. So,
well, engineers have transformed the industry, haven't they?
Oh, tremendously, tremendously. The convenience of the equipment these days, the quality of the equipment, even the cost of the equipment. And the equipment, not just the kinds we're talking about, like tape recorders, the things that we use in a broadcast studio, but also through the entire audio processing line, the processors that make the sound better to the ear when it finally comes out of the radio at your home or in your car, and the transmitters and the antennas, all those kinds of things, the engineers have made dramatic improvements.
Well, it's a thrilling story. What about, we've talked about equipment, the studios have changed too, haven't they?
Yeah. When you walk through this building, I've already told you that this building was built as a radio studio, and most stations today are located in buildings that were designed for some other purpose. Mm-hmm. You know, there was an office building or a store building. It seemed to be the right kind of right space, right size, etc. Let's put a radio station there. This studio was built with each studio being a separate building within a building, separate foundation, separate walls within the walls, etc., for soundproofing purposes. Nowadays, they don't go to all those troubles. That's not to say that they don't get good quality these days because of the changes in equipment. It isn't necessary. Radio stations these days often will have one or two studios. You'll see offices and offices and offices, and then only one or two studios in many radio stations. Here we still have 1, 2, 3 control rooms and 1, 2, 3 studios in addition to the control rooms.
And you need them all.
Oh, we need more. But the equipment within the studios has changed as well. The microphones are much better quality. Remote starts of equipment, tape recorder, for instance, with a commercial in it would be located in one room. An announcer in a studio in another room can play that commercial, which is located on a tape in another room. Back timing clocks, earphones, conveniences.
Didn't there used to be a lot of draperies, velvet, and absorbing material?
Yeah, mostly absorbing material is the proper term. sound audio has a way of bouncing off of a hard wall and coming back and bouncing again off the other wall, and by the time it finally gets into the microphone, it's bounced around quite a bit, and the audio quality changes. Often you hear a hollow type sound, or as the engineers call it, a hard sound to the audio quality. So yeah, they soften it with the draperies. Yeah. Nowadays, yeah. Acoustical tile mm-hmm. performs that in most studios.
Much better, easier. Mm-hmm. Well, that tells us this advance that we have made in that field. What about government supervision?
Oh, it's there.
It's still there.
Yeah, always has been. Federal Communications Commission is the regulating body of broadcast, and all broadcast, not just commercial radio, but all broadcast, from citizens band radio to ham operators, television, etc.
Is that necessary?
Yeah, probably is. The most necessary part is the technical regulation, mm-hmm. I believe, mm-hmm. strictly my opinion. If there were no regulation, then every radio station in the world, if it wanted, could be at the same dial position that we're on.
And we have had instances in the past, haven't we, of the frustration that occurs.
And there have been some very recent instances of that kind of frustration caused by government. Mm-hmm. Give you an example. Are you familiar with the term Radio Marti?
Yes.
Cuban interference. A Cuban broadcasting station broadcasting on a frequency that's occupied by American radio stations. There was a station in a neighboring state, Iowa, that suffered the interference from this Cuban broadcasting station. And they did it in order to jam the radio broadcast of the American station. Without government regulation, all stations could broadcast on the same frequency or with unregulated power. They could interfere with one another. So, yeah, from a technical standpoint, most of all, I think government regulation is important.
And this has to be international, though, doesn't it?
And it is, in fact. It is international. An example of that, the history of Radio Indicator includes WDZ moving from Tuscola to Decatur, going on the air in Decatur sometime in the 40s, I believe, as a daytime-only station. 10:50 on the dial. They could sign on at sunrise, and when the sun went down, they had to sign off. This was because of an international treaty, a treaty that the American government had with the Mexican government. And there are many of those treaties around the world. This particular treaty protected the Mexican stations, which were on the air at 10:50 on the dial, AM dial, as was WDZ. It protected them from being jammed by an American station at that dial position. You know, in a broad sense, the AM radio frequency signals travel farther at night. So if WDZ were on the air at 1,000 watts in the daytime, their signal might travel 60 miles, 70 miles, etc. At nighttime, it might travel for 1,000 miles or even further, depending upon things like atmospheric conditions. If a radio station in Mexico on the same frequency was enjoying a good, clear signal, the listeners there in Mexico could hear that just fine, and then along comes WDZ in Decatur, Illinois, at the same frequency, suddenly there is nothing but interference, static. So this Mexican treaty protected the Mexican radio stations from interference by American stations at 10:50 on the dial. So yeah, international treaties.
You don't have any quarrel then with government supervision in a technical sense?
Absolutely not.
Is there any interference with programming?
No, not really. There have been things that a lot of broadcasters referred to as interference, and a lot of people referred to as being government interference in programming. This station has not ever called it that, and my own belief is is not that it's interference. It might be troublesome at times. But things like, we are required, broadcasters are licensed to serve the public need. Perhaps you would say that's interference. If the government says you have a license to broadcast to serve the public need, perhaps you would say, oh, wait a minute, I want to serve my own needs.
But the people on the airwaves, don't they?
True. True. But can you be licensed to serve your own needs, or do you have to serve the people's needs? And who defines what the people's needs are? Well, the answer to that in this case, in this circumstance, is that radio stations are required by regulation, by the FCC, to determine through what is now called ascertainment, to determine what the community needs are. And we do that through an interview process, ongoing process of studying the local community by talking to the community leaders. We know from the mayor's comments, the mayor telling us what he thinks Decatur's needs are. We know from the school superintendents. We know from community leaders of all kinds what we feel the greatest needs in Decatur are at any given time. And we must then address those needs in some part of our programming.
When you have to renew your license, you are required to advertise to the public that people can tell you their needs?
Yes.
So that gives you a clue to the way the people regard the station?
Well, potentially it would, but it doesn't happen that way.
Well, because maybe the people appreciate and enjoy and are satisfied.
Yeah, maybe they aren't dissatisfied. I can't remember when one of those announcements has stirred a response.
All of this isn't free. Somebody has to pay. What about financial support?
Radio is looked on by the listener, the consumer, if you will, the person who consumes the product or service, looked on as an entertainment and information source. From the management and ownership standpoint, though, it is looked upon additionally as a potential profit source. We are commercial radio, and that term simply means that we're in it to make money. The profit motive has built the American system. And yes, we are a profit-making organization. It's designed that way, it's intended that way, and it continues to be that way. The only source for revenue is the selling of advertising.
Has advertising changed much over these years?
Style has changed. Style. That's about the only thing that's changed, really. But the basics of advertising really have not changed. The basic of advertising is to make certain your potential customer is aware that you and your products or services exist and that they have a benefit for you. And those things haven't changed. Just the style in which you present them, that's changed.
Okay. And we've already talked about network affiliation. That's still a big help to local broadcasting.
Yes, in the sense that it gives us much better access to national and international news and sports. Without a network affiliation, it would be very difficult for a local radio station to cover the inauguration of a president of the United States. It would be very difficult for a local station to cover any news event more than, say, 50 miles away from its hometown. It'd be very difficult. But the
and expensive.
Oh, yes, yes. But the national affiliation, the network, gives us the ability to do that.
But you couldn't plug into a network all day long and satisfy your needs of your community, could you?
That's correct. That's correct. Nor would you satisfy, well, the networks don't give us programming all day long either. The networks that we have talked about, like the like CBS, NBC. There are other networks that do, and some radio stations use them, music networks. But at this station, we provide much of our programming locally.
What about changes in programming? Are there some programs that stand out in your memory that have come about as making a change in broadcasting here?
It's a good question. Radio programming changes, as we described earlier, from locally produced program to basically network programming, very much as television is today, and then it changed back to local programming. When television came along, most folks thought radio was dead, and radio did suffer a great deal. But the golden days of radio really are today, because more people listen to radio for longer periods of time than ever in history. There are more radio stations, both AM and FM, than ever before. Radio has grown dramatically even since television, so the programming had to change to account for that. Dropping the of the network programs such as the soap operas and the information shows and entertainment shows like Arthur Godfrey and Art Linkletter's House Party, etc. Dropping those meant providing locally done programs, and radio stations went to music shows, changed music formats to appeal to various age or sex demographics. Radio at one time was basically all aimed at the family. And now, with the number of radio stations, the size of the audience available, radio stations, instead of just all aiming at the family, they're able to aim at a certain part of the population. Some radio stations appeal only to 18 to 24-year-olds. Some radio stations are basically teen-oriented. Other radio stations are searching for an audience that's basically 35-plus, and they do that by offering programming that appeals to that particular age or sex demographic. There are some stations in the major markets that say, my target is women 18 to 34. They'll take all the listeners they can get, but their target audience would be a very narrow demographic. So programming changed to meet those needs. As more radio stations go on the air, then each station has to specialize a little bit more to attract a particular audience. I can localize that. In Decatur, for many years, we had two radio stations, WSOY and WDZ. We actually had three stations, WSOY-FM, but it carried the same programs that were on the air on WSOY-AM. The two stations were, in effect, joint. They were, in effect, one station. Two different signals, one FM, one AM, but same program. Later, the two stations separated and offered different program. And today, from the standpoint of the casual listener, those two stations are not the same at all. They're not WSOY and WSOY-FM. They are, in fact, WSOY and Y103. WDZ still exists. But SOY remains basically an adult-oriented station with information, a great deal of news, CBS radio, a lot of local news, local personalities. WSOY-FM, known to the public as Y103, is a stereo rock station and going after a different age group, basically. The WSOY-FM station, Y103, is aimed targeted at the 18 to 34-year-old. Many of us adults think it's a teen station, but it is not. In the rating books, it shows up. 18 to 34 is very, very strong. WSOY-AM is aimed at the 25-plus person. So that's a good example of how radio stations have changed their programming to try to carve out a niche in the marketplace.
Well, Well, that instead of having a family grouped around a receiver in the living room, we have individuals mm-hmm. listening.
Yeah. That's an excellent point. There was a time when radio was consumed as a family unit, and now it's not. Mm-hmm. Radio is consumed by the individual. Mm-hmm. That's why radio has one of its great strengths, because a radio personality or a radio commercial or a radio program can be aimed directly at an individual. If a radio announcer says, as you often hear in radio, "Hey, all of you out there listening to us today," my personal opinion is that radio announcer is making a mistake, because you do not listen as a group, you listen as an individual. That radio announcer instead should say, "You're having a nice day today, right?"
Right.
Speaking directly to the individual.
True.
And that's one of radio's great strengths. The individual listens as an individual. Mm-hmm. So you have the ability to talk directly.
Person to person.
Mm-hmm. That's one of radio's great strengths. Kind of like that Uncle Sam poster. You remember that great poster of Uncle Sam? "I want you," from no matter where you stand around that poster, he's pointing directly at you. And that's kind of what radio is like. It goes directly to the individual.
Well, when programs could go out of the studio as a station to a remote location, it made a big difference, didn't it?
For a long time, radio enjoyed that as an exclusive. There was no ability on the part of any other medium to do a remote broadcast until very recent years. And for that reason, radio was the first to bring you the man on the moon. You first heard the man on the moon on radio, strictly audio, into your ears. There was no picture from there, no live picture. The only pictures that came back were pictures taken at the time and brought back, and television saw them afterwards. Remote broadcasting began back in the 40s as well. And remote broadcasting was done in a fashion similar to what we do it today, but with much more cumbersome equipment and with much less audio quality. You'd carry large pieces of equipment, amplifiers and so forth, out to a remote location. You did need power, AC. Back in the early days of remote broadcasting, there were very few battery-powered transmitters or amplifiers. So you'd have to have power. You'd have to be someplace that power was available.
And telephone lines? Did you have to have telephone lines?
The remote broadcast back in those days took place, as they do today, with either telephone lines or remote transmitters. Mm-hmm. There were some of each. With the telephone lines, you would order, you'd know where you're going to do the remote broadcast, and you would know that the president is going to be at the airport a week from Friday, and you would call the telephone company, a special department at the telephone company. You'd order what was known as a broadcast loop, and this special line would be installed out at the airport, and you'd go out there and merely plug your equipment into that, and the signal went from your microphone to the amplifier and down a wire to the telephone block, telephone terminal, then to the telephone company, and eventually out to the control board at the radio station and on the air, and almost all instantaneously. You know, there's less of that done now. We still use a lot of telephone lines for broadcast purposes, but now there is much less of that done, partially because of the lower cost technology making other lower cost avenues available. And at the same time that was happening, the cost of telephone lines was increasing. So more and more remote broadcasts are done.
Quality too.
Yeah, quality is better through a non-line broadcast. Mm-hmm. So with a remote transmitter broadcasting from a mobile news unit, it broadcasts on a separate frequency back to your control board, then it's processed and goes out through your main transmitter and the listener hears it. If you can broadcast through a remote transmitter, not using a telephone line, You usually get better quality, and you also usually save money on the technical costs. Networks, for instance, were distributed by telephone line. There was a telephone line, that's where it gets its name, network. A wire strung from New York to Philadelphia to Pittsburgh to Columbus to Cincinnati to Indianapolis and to Decatur, et cetera. And the distribution system, the network of wires all across the country, distributing this CBS radio network all by wire, by telephone wire. Well, the networks now distribute by satellite. And it is, it goes from the network in New York, say, or Los Angeles, or wherever, Chicago. It goes, it's transmitted up in an uplink from a from an Earth station up to a satellite, and then received at the all the receiving stations. So the telephone lines are no more for network broadcast routinely.
Remote broadcasting made the sport play-by-play sports possible too.
Sure did, and that was, I guess, one of the major changes in radio programming was the ability to do an on-the-spot remote broadcast from a special event, like a very exciting baseball game, the World Series, or in Decatur, high school basketball, the Running Reds from Kintner Gymnasium, University of Illinois basketball. As a matter of fact, WJBL broadcast its first University of Illinois basketball game in 1938. U of I played IU at Bloomington, Indiana, and listeners in Decatur back in 1938, 49 years ago, heard that broadcast. In that same year, Millikan University basketball game, first Decatur High School basketball game was broadcast from Effingham. Decatur High School playing at Effingham, December 17, 1938. And I bet it was Merrill Lindsay who did the play-by-play of the game.
He enjoyed that.
Oh, yeah, he was good at play-by-play sports. Super.
Did you ever have any disasters and emergencies broadcast?
I think one of radio's great strengths is its ability to be on the spot quickly, to reach the individual at times when another medium cannot. And so radio has often been the primary source of information during emergency circumstances, emergency situations. Take something like the tragedy of a tornado. A tornado comes through and hits a village or a section of Decatur or something, as has happened in the past a time or two, tears down buildings, and the storm also has associated with it enough wind that it will cause power to be out. Now, your television is powered by AC electricity. You don't have a battery-powered television. There are a few around, but most of us have television sets that don't operate if your power's out, but you have a radio. Radio stations have, many of them, have generators of their own. This station has. We have two generators. When the power goes out, we can still broadcast. Television stations do not have generators, for the most part. So the television station cannot broadcast, the radio station can. You as a consumer in your home probably cannot receive television anyway if it were on the air. But you can receive radio with your transistor radio or your car radio. So radio then has the opportunity and responsibility to serve a great need in times of emergency and disaster, and has over the years many times. This radio station has been on the air many, many times when no other broadcast was available. The most memorable time in my 25 years or so Decatur radio was an ice storm, Easter weekend, 1970.
Good Friday.
Yeah, it was Good Friday. 1978?
I believe, about that time.
Might have been 1975.
No.
78, okay. It was Good Friday, and light rain was falling, and the temperature was hovering right at the freezing point, and before too long there was so much ice around that power lines snapped, and the entire community lost power. Illinois Power Company had, as I recall, four main transmission lines serving Decatur from outside sources, coming in from four different directions, and one of those main lines would go down, so a part of Decatur would be out of power, and then a few hours later another one would go down, and before long the entire community was without power. The radio stations that did not have generators were off the air. Our stations were the only ones here on the air, and I think we were the only ones in about a 40-mile radius on the air for a great part of that weekend. It was several days before some people got power back. Much of the community got power back by sometime Easter Sunday, I believe, or the day after. But some people in rural areas didn't get power back for as much as 2 weeks later. So we were the only source of information for a large number of people. In a circumstance like that, we forego all of the things that we routinely do. We routinely have a commercial at a certain time. No, we don't do that. We routinely have a music program that includes this or that kind of music at a certain time. No. We stop all of our regular broadcasting and we go completely to information programming. The responsibility that I mentioned earlier about serving the public need is far greater than, it's of far more importance than the regulation. A good radio station, I think, is not at all bothered by that regulation, as we discussed
you
earlier.
You would do it anyway.
You gotta do it. Mm-hmm. You want to serve the public. That's your real responsibility. Mm-hmm. And this radio station has taken it seriously for a long time. We just interrupt all commercial programming, all of our regular programming, and offer information. We try to gather as much information and provide as much information. When is power going to come back on? How can I keep the meat in my freezer mm-hmm. from thawing? What do I do? Any steps I can take? How do I keep warm? Mm-hmm. Where can I go to keep warm if my house is so cold? Where can I take my pets? Mm-hmm. I have two little youngsters, and it is 35 degrees in this house. What can I do? You know, all those kinds of needs have to be addressed by someone, and this radio station, in a circumstance like that, is the one we can serve. Comes a snow emergency in the wintertime. You're snowed in, and the whole community is snowed in, and this has happened many times over the years. And there is a lady in a farm community 15 miles out that can't get to the hospital and is about to go into delivery. You know, you have to get the lady to a doctor or the obstetrician to the lady, you know. And when other sources can't find a way to get them together through the, you know, the normal routine, this radio station has served the need. You found somebody with a snowblower, and you got the doctor, and you, or not a snowblower, but a snowmobile, mm-hmm. and you get the two together. And this radio station has served that kind of need, sort of a catalyst at times of emergency.
And people appreciate that.
Well, I think so. Little things like school closings mm-hmm. Seems little now as we talk about it on a sunny day in the summertime, but in the wintertime when there are several thousand school students who don't know whether or not their school is going to be open because of last night's snowfall, it's a big thing. So we have the information.
Well, you certainly have told us of the importance of radio today. Is there anything else that you would say about your feeling about radio today?
I guess I don't know what you're driving at.
Well, we are now, radio is a great source of information, we've mm-hmm. already said, and a great deal of very vital information given to the public, and as well as entertainment, and mm-hmm. local, it builds a neighborhood, doesn't it?
I think so. I think radio has an opportunity to pull a community together. It has an equal opportunity to tear a community apart. But an opportunity to pull the community together, to build a spirit for a community. We have an opportunity because of the power of the medium to do some things that no other medium can do. And I hope we do it. As an industry, I hope we do it. I think we do.
I think so, too. Well, let's talk a little bit about, and you can see that this will be the future of radio, too.
Do
you have any ideas of how it might change in the future, or do you want to have more of the same?
There are a lot of changes that are taking place. One thing I failed to mention as we talked about the history of radio was the change of the FM as a medium. There was a time when FM was right here, and in most communities, FM was kind of a stepsister to the AM. The AM had the dominant audience, and FM was on the air, but programmed in the most inexpensive way at a lot of places, where it was either programming the same thing that its sister AM station programmed, as we did, or in many markets, an album of beautiful music, so-called beautiful music, would be put on the turntable, and the record plays the whole album, and when that album is finished, another album follows it. And that was the most inexpensive way to program it, and the reason you had to do it inexpensively was you had very little revenue because you had fewer listeners. Well, FM became very strong. It has a much better technical quality than AM has had. Became very strong, and in most markets in the country these days, FM has more listeners than AM. So that was true here. We changed our FM station. We changed our programming. We developed a much better audience for FM here than we ever had before, but another thing happened. Another FM station comes in the market. Here comes WDZQ, an FM station with country and western music. They signed on in 1978. I think that's about right. And here comes another one, WXFM, which is really licensed to Mount Zion, but it's a Mount Zion Decatur station. For all intents and purposes, it's a Decatur area radio station. And the FCC has opened the window, if I can use that term, for another FM station that can conceivably come to Decatur within the next 3 or 4 years. So there might be an additional radio station here. So that's one of the changes that's taking place in radio, including radio in Decatur. That is, more signals, more local stations. The technological changes include AM stereo. Many radio stations across the country are now broadcasting in stereo on the AM. Not possible 5 years ago. There are some who think that's going to be the salvation of AM radio. They think AM radio is on the way out because of the technical superiority of the FM signal. And along comes the ability to broadcast in stereo on AM, and they think, oh, that's going to bring AM back to life. Personally, I don't think so. If a radio station's broadcasting in stereo, but you don't have a stereo receiver in your car, then that stereo signal means nothing to you. And that's the case for most people. So I don't think that's going to be a major change, but it's talked a lot about in the industry these days. Quality will improve, though. And I think the quality of programming in the future, quality of local involvement in programming by radio stations will improve as competition gets tougher and tougher and tougher. Radio stations all have to do a better job.
Again, they will, too.
I think so.
You talked about the field of radio. What about you yourself, Mr. Graham? How did you happen to get into this area of work?
I guess I started in my desire, my interest started in high school, in a high school speech class.
Where did you go to high school?
Rushville, Indiana.
Oh.
High school speech class, George Pond was our speech teacher, and there was a radio station in a little town, Connersville, Indiana, about 20 miles east of us, and he made arrangements with that radio station that our high school speech club would produce a radio program on their radio station, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, once a month or something. And so we would rehearse a radio play or a radio comedy. We'd rehearse for several days in our classroom, and then we'd go over and we'd be on the air. Mm-hmm. And the radio station, or the high school, where I went to high school, would turn the radio onto the PA system so the students throughout the building could hear us on the air. That's where my interest started. Yeah, and then I went on to school in Portland, Oregon, and started in radio in 1961 in a radio station in Hillsdale, Michigan, WCSR in Hillsdale, Michigan. Was there a year, and then I came here. I've been here since.
Well, very good. Well, I believe you've already given us a good deal about your feelings about broadcasting, that you feel it is certainly is a very important means of communication and so on. Do you want to add anything? Do you have any philosophy other than you've already told us? The public is your main concern, right?
Well, yeah. Yeah, if you do not serve the public, they're not going to listen to you. Mm-hmm. They shouldn't. Mm-hmm. Some people apologize to me and say, oh, I never listened to your station. I said, don't apologize. If we're not serving you, if we're not giving you what you want, you shouldn't listen to us. It doesn't offend me at all. And of course, we all know we can't please everybody. None of us can. But a radio station that serves the need is going to be listened to. And we have the ability to influence. Because we can influence, we have then the ability to sell commercials, advertising, which then gives us the ability to have a staff of people. It's the free enterprise system. The more people we have on the staff doing a better job, the better job that we can do. It's the domino. It's the old cycle, the old life cycle. We just keep on doing better. And it all starts with giving the customer what they want. That's where it all starts. And that's by philosophy, both in programming and in the business side, in the sales. You give the customer what something will benefit the customer and something that they want, then they're going to take it. And they'll take it from you. You're not selling it to them. They take it from you. If they need it and want it, then they take it from you, whether they're a listener to a broadcast station or whether they're a buyer of commercials, advertising.
Well, I'm sure the people at Decatur appreciate what you've given them and what other people in broadcasting in Decatur have done for them. It's very difficult, as we said at the beginning, to conceive of life today without broadcasting. And we do appreciate your efforts.
It's fun remembering these things. Thank you for including me.
Well, we appreciate very much your sharing these experiences with us, Mr. Graham. Thank you. And this is Betty Trunell speaking for the Decatur Public Library.